Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how content creators may help influence this year's election.
And we meet the next chef in our series Chef Talk at a tiny restaurant called Sushi Friend.
But first, Arizona might not be seen as a trailblazer in progressive politics. But there is one area where some would say we excel in that arena. Women. Arizona has a long history of women in leadership on both sides of the aisle, from Governors Rose Mofford and Jane Hull to Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and our state's longest-serving state legislator, Polly Rosenbaum. Women have long played an outsized role in Arizona's politics. Sue Gerard served in the state legislature for more than a decade, starting in the 1980s. She was around during the time of the so-called Fab Five, when five women were elected to the state's most important positions, governor to superintendent.
Well, part of it, we always used to say, it's a small market, so you can run a campaign pretty cheaply.
Right.
So, you know, women clearly have more trouble raising funds than men did that many years ago. And the idea of women pioneers that were out there alongside their husbands or after their husbands died, turning fields and running cattle and everything else because they had to. It was a different attitude because, you know, it was really rural here. And so that attitude of women have been and know how to and are very capable of running a ranch, running a farm, running a business that maybe you didn't see in, you know, other parts of the country.
But Gerard told me she doesn't think excelling in women's leadership led to significantly better policy in Arizona or changed her own role in state governing.
Personally, I think I got more picked on because they knew they couldn't make me compromise. They couldn't get me to back off. They couldn't keep me to shut up. It didn't have anything to do with my sex, I don't think.
But our next guest this morning sees it a little differently, from behind the scenes. Janine LeCure is a longtime journalist and communications advisor in Arizona. Today, she's chief of staff for strategic planning and communication for Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell. She's been involved with Arizona politics since she was a kid. Her mom ran for the state legislature. Her dad was chief of staff to an Arizona congressman. She told me what was happening in Arizona politics was dinner table conversation for them. She spent much of her career working in local TV news, which was dominated by men then. So when she left news and went into politics, she's largely worked for women, starting with former Governor Janet Napolitano.
I had met Janet Napolitano a couple of times. Once was on Channel 8, as a matter of fact, the PBS station. And she said some things to me off camera that, frankly, were so appropriate and so inappropriate for air that I fell instantly in love with her.
Okay.
So that was my entry. But what I've noticed in my own career since is, and it could be because of the experiences I had in television news, which in some cases were quite ugly, I made a more conscious decision to be working with women who I saw as visionary leaders who are working on the kinds of things that I can get behind. I do think it's important to say that I have never worked for somebody with whom I agreed 100%.
Sure.
Ever.
Yeah.
But the women that I like are the ones who are thoughtful and courageous and willing to step out based on their belief system.
So I want to back up then and talk a little bit more about the history of this in the state, which you were kind of witnessing as you grew up here, it sounds like, as well. When you think about women in Arizona politics, leaders in that realm from the history of this state, which isn't very long, really.
No.
Who do you think of?
My first encounter with a woman in politics, I probably was a very young teenager or a tween. My dad was working at the state capitol, and I got to meet Polly Rosenbaum, who, even at that time, even though she served for quite a bit longer after I first met her, was already a legend. I sort of fall into that camp of people who think that there's some pioneer, frontier, Wild West sort of thing that goes on there. And Polly expressed this before she died. Women weren't exempt from the work. You know, if you're running a ranch, as did Justice O'Connor,
right.
If you are raising kids, whatever your vocation in life is, there's a lot of work that goes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, to me, was an introduction to thinking differently about power in politics. Women handle power differently than men, I believe. Now, there are probably some great scholars who can dispute me on that point. But I think women handle and manage power differently.
I mean, obviously, we've had lots of women in power in Arizona's history, but lots of women behind the scenes kind of wielding a lot of power as well,
oh, yeah.
which you've experienced.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, every candidate has some partner in their life. But I look at, for example, Bruce Babbitt, who I admired greatly. But the woman I always think about is Hattie Babbitt, who was doing innumerable other things in D.C. and here to the benefit of Arizona before, during, and after Bruce was in office.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just example after example after example of that. Some people are like me. They tend to be on the staff. I used to aspire to run for office, and then I realized what the personal sacrifice was going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was not something I wanted to have for myself,
mm-hmm.
which also feeds into the great admiration I have for the women I've worked for who saw that same equation and said, yeah, I am going to do it.
Do you think it's harder for a woman? I mean, there's lots of talk, obviously, about in this current election cycle about, you know, having a woman running for president for the second time ever. And we see this when women run for office locally as well. It's a lot of talk about style and clothing and hair and makeup. And I think less so today. That's become more taboo, but it's still there.
Hmm.
Does that have any implications, you think, on how women conduct themselves and whether or not they want those offices?
I would answer that question two ways.
Okay.
The first way I would say is I think what many of us have come to is making a decision about the person and less gender-based. So I do see sort of an evening out in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. It does happen to men, too. But if a hair is out of place, if something doesn't fit quite right, when I was on television, I would do investigations, I would put them on the air, and then I would get calls, not email, thank heaven, that was not as big a thing back then. But I would get calls from people saying, you'd be so much happier if you lost some weight.
Mm.
Or, you know, your hair looked funny. Things like that. When I thought I had just put on, you know, a really good story that I worked on very hard for a very long time.
Yeah.
That happens to elected women constantly. When you see the calls and emails and tweets and things that are directed at women in office, some of it is just ugly. Janet Napolitano. Back in the day, one of the things that she said to me, well, there were many wonderful things she said to me, but, you know, she had a string of pearls that she wore most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that she particularly liked pearls, but it cut off an avenue of questioning.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, right, I want to ask you about Janet Napolitano and Rachel Mitchell, who you work for now, both very high-powered women in the state with maybe similar attributes, but also some very big differences, notably party.
Right.
Tell us about looking back at the first woman you worked for in Arizona politics, right, and who you're working for now. Do you see any through lines?
I do. I see more similarities than I see differences.
Mm.
What I see is two women who are brilliant, very accomplished lawyers.
Mm.
These are women who maintain an equilibrium. They maintain an equilibrium when they go about their jobs. Heaven knows that there probably is a private price that both of them have paid for choosing this kind of a very public life. But they don't show that to the world. And that to me is more important than party politics.
I want to ask you about Arizona in this and why you think Arizona seems to be unique in this, in the sense that there have been more women in leadership roles here for longer than lots of other places in the country. I wonder what you think about Arizona's role in this. Why Arizona?
I don't know why Arizona, but what I love about it is the fact that, you know, I mentioned Polly Rosenbaum. There were so many women that also saw that and were inspired to run for office. Even before. Again, I think it's some of that pioneer background. The women are just as tough as the men. They still had to handle a shotgun. They still had to be able to chase bad guys off their property, all that kind of stuff. But what now we have is a situation in which women have seen other women in leadership positions. You know, I'm 66 years old. This has been true through my entire life, which is quite remarkable, I think.
Yeah.
And to stand here today and be able to say, yeah, there's a bunch of women who have been in office in Arizona, have served well, and we always, you know, ride on the shoulders of those who came before us. So there's another group of women coming up now mm-hmm. who are riding the shoulders. They may not ever have had the chance to meet Polly Rosenbaum, but they're living with the reality of what she was a part of creating.
So it's almost like this is a place where this is not even notable anymore. And that means a lot.
It's tradition, right? It's become a tradition.
So having watched this and recognized this tradition of women in leadership roles here in politics in our state for so long, do you think it's made a difference? Do you think that because women have been in control, it's turned out differently?
I think women have been in the conversation. You know, the Rio Salado Project, for example, you know, it's been 30 years and it may be another 30 years before it actually comes to fruition. But there are a lot of women, including Kate Gallego, who are working very hard to make that happen. Elaine Scruggs, gosh, even going back to Margaret Hance, they were in conversation about how transportation was going to unfold here in Arizona, but certainly in the valley, in the mm-hmm. immediate area around here. I think those issues have come to better resolutions than might have been possible had only white men been in leadership in this state for the last, let's say, 70 years. How different? I don't know. I don't think we'd be living in an apocalyptic sandstorm, but I think it would have been different.
All right. We'll leave it there. Janine LeCure joining us. She is a longtime journalist and policy and communications advisor here in Arizona. Janine, thank you so much for coming in to talk about this. I appreciate it.
It's a delight, Lauren. Thank you.
Social media influencers have been increasing their, well, influence, talking about subjects ranging from skin cream and fashion to politics and health. A number of them were credentialed to this summer's Republican and Democratic national conventions, and the White House earlier hosted its first Creator Economy Conference. But who are these content creators and influencers, and how do they tend to wield their influence? With me to talk about this is Amanda Kerberg, a PhD student at ASU's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And Amanda, let's start by defining our terms here. What is a content creator? Who are these people?
Yeah, so it's interesting because content creator has kind of come into vogue right now, but I would use it synonymously with influencer. But these are people who are at the most basic level, creating content, right? And what we've seen is as we've had generations grow up with these tools, more and more people are diving in and creating content, which is how we get these new identities of content creators. It kind of connects to a little bit of a few trends, both the kind of citizen journalism trend that, like, this upset of the role of, well, anyone can kind of be a journalist, mm-hmm. right? And then this, the aspect of fandom, because so much of our online interaction and experience is centered and kind of constructed around this logic of fandom.
And to be clear, these are generally people, the people we're talking about, are generally either on social media or some other
yes,
online platform.
Yes. Yeah, so they're creating either like videos, short form videos for TikTok, YouTube, traditionally we think of content creators as video centric, but you can also get influencers on platforms like Instagram who rely, you know, originally primarily on photos, or influencers who do blogs, still a big thing. So yeah, it's interesting because there isn't like an exact definition. There's some argument about whether you technically have to have a certain number of followers to deserve the term, like maybe 10,000 or more, like depending on what your reach is. But I would say I think that those boundaries are probably blurrier than we might give them credit.
Yeah. And, you know, we saw, for example, earlier this summer, both major party political conventions accredited, you know, content creators, influencers to come and cover these things. Was that just a way to maybe get people who aren't watching CNN or aren't watching the major TV networks to see what's going on and for the parties and the candidates to get their messages out to different people?
I think that's a lot of it. That sort of difficulty in reaching youth voters is definitely not new. Mm-hmm. But I think that we are in a point where people are realizing at least new tactics on how to better reach youth. The Biden administration began working with influencers in 2021 to get out vaccine information. And that was a lot to do with, hey, we need to reach young audiences. Where are they? Okay, they're on TikTok. Let's find some of these TikTok influencers. Let's connect with them. Let's connect them to their networks. And that kind of speaks to a broader issue in terms of how in the digital age audiences are so fragmented. So then after that, they moved into, okay, it's 2022. We'd like to start combating some of the misinformation about the war in Ukraine. But I think what's funny is even though we kind of chafe at new media, no matter what our era is, and the new ways, I mean, new language, new expressions. But even when it looks different, these values are not different. The kids on TikTok are dancing about important things. So even though it can look kind of goofy, I think, to different people, it is important. And I see increasingly it getting taken more seriously, exactly as you said. This was just a watershed moment to have 200 content creators credentialed like press at the DNC was amazing. I think the RNC this year had about 70.
Well, so how does that work? Like, if you're a content creator and you're invited to the RNC or the DNC, are you expected to just kind of be a mouthpiece for whatever they are saying and doing, and you just have to get the message out? Like, do you have the role of a traditional journalist where you're expected to fact check and think critically about what's being said and report what is actually true?
That is, I think, the question at the crux of all this, because it's something that we're still kind of figuring out.
Okay.
I mean, I think that, are they journalists? Yes and no. Are they advertisers? Yes and no. Are they still kind of trying to figure out who they are? Because I think, like, they're getting credentialed as journalists is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have the same kind of norms. They don't have necessarily the same kind of values or shared principles. They definitely do not believe in objectivity. So I think that it's a step in the right direction to recognize that we can't just look at them as these kind of new advertising entities. But what does that mean then when they move more into that space? Because they just don't operate like that kind of classic journalist. So we're at this, I think, kind of cusp of a turning point, because there are content creators talking now about, okay, as we start to professionalize, what are our ethical norms going to be? So you have people like V. Spehar of Under the Desk News on TikTok, or John Green of the Vlog Brothers, saying, you know what? Yeah, we've really appreciated being invited to have a seat at the table, but we are not going to go anymore if you don't let us talk, if you don't let us get our message across. So I think what I take from that is that this kind of, new generation of creators see themselves almost more as activists and advocates.
Well, it sounds like the equation and the calculation has to be, you know, these content creators can get our message out to millions or tens of millions of people. It might not be exactly the message we want to get out, but let's just hope it's something kind of approximating what we want. And it's going to go to a whole lot of people that otherwise, as you say, would never maybe even have heard of us.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, I mean, sharing information is definitely obviously part of these new spaces where, yeah, we see influencers and content creators taking on the mantle of sharing health information, sharing political information, sharing, you know, policy information and space and science information. And all that is so essential. And it's part of, like, how we're learning how to better share that information in these new platforms, mm-hmm. in these context collapse spaces where they're getting science information mixed in with, you know, memes and fun and goofy stuff. But yeah, it is also about, I think, sharing the spark of passion that will pay dividends for organizations and for campaigns. So even if that message is not as perfect as you would get it if you sat down in your marketing department or your owned media, at least, you know, if you can get the passion shared, the spark of curiosity, then you can call people in who may be, you know, future advocates, future ambassadors, future followers.
What do you see as the future of content creators?
Oh my gosh.
And by future, we can even mean
question.
Like six months down the road, right? It doesn't have to be like way off.
I think Okay, the thing that I am really excited about.
Let's hear it.
Is if they do start to professionalize and they sit down and they create a list of principles, I want to see what those look like. I want to see the 10 principles of ethical conduct for influencers and content creators today. Where do we stand? Are we closer to journalists? Are we closer to activists? You know, who are we closer to entertainers? Like, what is that going to look like when, you know, we get a committee of people together to actually nail it down?
All right. That is Amanda Carberg, a PhD student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication studying digital culture. Amanda, always nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll head to the locally owned Sushi Friend as part of our ongoing series, Chef Talk.
Well, there's just one day left. Election Day is tomorrow. And if you're heading to the polls, our next guest this morning is here to tell you your vote is safe. And you should be too. Why? Because our election officials in Arizona have been planning to keep you and your vote safe for more than a year. Elvia Diaz is the editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, and she joins me now on this Election Day Eve. Good morning there, Elvia.
Good morning.
Okay, so you're talking about safety in this editorial here, kind of voter safety, and it's kind of, there are two levels to this, which is interesting, right? You're talking about both the security of your vote, which we'll get to in a moment, but people's actual physical safety at the polls as well. And when I was reading this editorial, it struck me how that wouldn't have even been part of the conversation just a few election cycles ago, and how much our politics have changed.
Well, yes. And you know what, two cycles ago or many cycles ago, the physical safety had been there, has been there, as well as the security of the ballot, right? It's just the politics and the rhetoric that changed in the previous election. And so the same thing this year, you know, the safety of the physical ballot is safe. Now, you know, election officials, of course, have learned a lot since 2020, and they have added a lot of layers, I'll say several layers, to the physical protection of the voters and also to the ballot to ensure everyone for the millionth time that they're ready in case there are some bad actors, but you know that the ballot itself is safe.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about the layers of protection here that you write about in terms of that giving physical safety and just sort of peace of mind to voters who will probably be in lines at the polls tomorrow.
Well, you know, officials are not telling us details as they shouldn't, right? I mean, they're not divulging what exactly they're going to be doing, you know, how many people they're going to have, how many officers they're going to have in each location and where they are going to be. But the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, for instance, tells everyone, you know, that they'll be full staff tomorrow, so that they're going to be in full force. And the sheriff tells us that there's going to be absolutely no room for error there, that they're ready, that they'll respond to anything. They don't want a repeat of the 2020. If you recall, you know, armed protesters gather outside the election headquarters. Mm-hmm. And so they are ready for that in case, you know, that happens again. And so they're using perimeter fencing and barricades. And then if you actually drive around that office, you see that they have added extra physical barriers and security than they had in 2020. So it's going to be a lot more difficult to get into the building itself, so, you know, that there's going to be protection within the legal limits, right? Because there is a legal limit of 75 feet, right, that people can actually gather. So that's the county, right? The Secretary of State also, and, you know, state elected officials have also added their own layers of physical protection.
Okay, so that is one layer of this. So let's talk also about the other big part of this, right, which has gotten so much attention of late, which is whether or not our votes will be counted fairly, whether or not our elections are secure, whether or not someone can steal them, some bad actor, right? What protections are in place for that?
Well, to begin with, an army of people are looking, physically looking at the ballot. Already we know that a lot of people have voted early. They have dropped off their ballots to do it in person. And when they do, they are volunteers from both parties, you know, looking at it, in addition to the workers, right? The paid workers. And so the same thing here, that there are going to be so many eyes from both parties, from different parties and paid workers looking at the ballots. So they're just going to have eyes 24/7 on those ballots. And so that gives me a lot of confidence. So that's the physical human being, right? Looking at it. But then they also have cameras that are secured. And so those are some of the things that we know for sure. So just to remind voters that they can look at it, it is safe. You know, it is a physical paper that we can see.
So there's a change since the last election as well, in that both parties, Republicans and Democrats, are now expressing confidence in our elections going into it. What's changed here, especially on the Republican side, which featured many people who have denied the results of the election of late?
Well, to begin with, one thing that has surprised me, it's the chairwoman of the Arizona Republican Party. She has been actually great in terms of sending signals and saying it clearly and repeatedly that election workers are just doing their jobs, essentially that they're not cheating, right? Mm-hmm. And that they will not. So I think the message has shifted, and it has helped that it's coming from her. You know, it gives me hope that people are actually listening to her, listening to that. You know, the candidates, some of the candidates are the same, and some of the candidates are spewing the same rhetoric as last time, not with the same intensity, you know, but I clearly already hear, you know, some candidates saying that they will lose only if the other side cheats, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't help. But yes, I mean, it's great that people are listening to that. And it's also, you know, the fact that last time in 2020, if you remember, the Republicans were telling their people, do not vote early. Right. Do not trust your vote. Do it in person, right? That is not the case now. It's the opposite, the total opposite. Now they had been telling them, vote early, vote early, vote early. And, you know, Republicans apparently have listened to that and did vote early in great numbers.
Yeah, which is a big change. So we talked about both parties now sort of saying, yes, our elections will be fair. You should vote early. Is that kind of confidence spreading to voters? Are we seeing that spill over?
I believe so. I mean, they are people, and you see it on social media and you hear it on some radio stations and also in TV, that are going to continue to spread misinformation and essentially lie about the security of the ballot. But thank goodness that people are beginning to hear that. We will see. I mean, we will really see on election day and night in the coming days to see if people are going to have trust, you know, after the results start coming in, you know, the biggest test, of course, is if your side is losing and you still say, fine, you know, we respect the will of the people. That's what I'm looking for. That's going to be the real test.
Mm-hmm. That'll be the real test. All right. We will wait and see what happens, and it won't take long. Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, just one day before Election Day. Elvia, thank you so much, as always. Appreciate it.
No, thank you. Reminding everyone to vote tomorrow if you haven't done so.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Tomorrow is, of course, Election Day here in the United States, but this isn't the only place where voters are heading to the polls. Islanders from the tiny Pacific nation of Palau will cast their votes in a presidential election tomorrow, in a contest that some see as symbolizing the growing fight for influence between Washington and Beijing across the Pacific. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. And Pete, what can you tell us about this election?
Yeah, that's right, Mark. As you say, there's not the only election in town tomorrow, also taking place in the Pacific nation of Palau. is a vote for a new president, a Senate, and a House of Delegates. Now, this is the latest election in the region, which many commentators reckon symbolizes the growing tussle, as you mentioned, for influence in the region between Washington and Beijing. And that's playing out across these small Pacific nations who are beginning to feel more aggrieved by the West, ignoring them to some extent, and particularly their growing climate concerns. Palau, just to give you a bit of background, has close ties with the US. It was under US administration following World War II. And earlier this year, Palau signed or renewed an agreement with Washington, something called a Compact of Free Association. Essentially, it's a deal that will see the nation, the small island nation, receive $890 million in economic assistance from the US over the next 20 years. In return, Washington will be allowed to continue to have military access to the maritime zone, air, space, and land of Palau. But back onto the main issues. I think, you know, for the residents of Palau, the environment is, of course, very, very important to them. Global warming, the fact that they're out there in the North Pacific and you know, concerns about rising sea levels. But also they have the concerns, you know, very similar to many, you know, you and I and your listeners, Mark, cost of living, inflation, economic pressures that the island's coming under. So I think it's a combination of those things that has seen some on the island look towards Beijing as it's offering up perhaps some other incentives to move towards Beijing. One other really major important issue and why this is quite a significant election is that Palau is one of only 13 nations to recognize Taiwan. And have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. So these Pacific nations, there was a couple of other elections earlier this year, one in Tuvalu, which opted to stick with the pro-US and pro-West president, whereas another island, Nauru, that tilted away from Taiwan to China with its presidential elections in January. So that's the main thing here, this push and pull between the US and China and the competing policies of both the US and Washington, and it'll be very interesting to see if it follows which path it decides to take, to stay with close ties to Washington or whether it might start to pivot and tilt towards Beijing.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right, Pete, let's turn now to the war in Ukraine and the possible impact of a growing alliance between Russia and North Korea. That's amid reports that Pyongyang has sent thousands of troops to support Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What's the latest here?
Yeah, I'd say concerns have been building in the West for quite some time about the cooperation between North Korea and Russia, particularly after Russia in full-scale invasion of Ukraine, which incidentally, November 19th, this month, the 19th, marks 1,000 days since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now, North Korea and Russia have always had somewhat of an alliance, of course. Both countries share a deep-seated opposition to the US and its allies, and both face extensive sanctions and international isolation. Russia, particularly since its, you know, full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Since then, Moscow has turned to Pyongyang to provide Russia with artillery shells and other munitions. And in return, North Korea hoped to gain access to Russian military technologies and expertise. So last week, it was confirmed that North Korea was doing more, though, than sending artillery to Russia when both Washington and NATO confirmed that as many as 10 to 12,000 North Korean troops had been deployed to Russia and have subsequently been sent to the border with Ukraine. So this week, watch out for the latest developments on that. It will be a major development, and fair to say, I think, the first large-scale deployment of foreign troops into the Russian-Ukraine war since Moscow's full-scale invasion, as I mentioned, back in February of 2022. The other major development that occurred last week was an intercontinental missile test by North Korea, said to have traveled longer and further than ever before. Many military analysts saying that it indicates that North Korea might now have the technology to strike anywhere in the U.S. with a ballistic missile. And that, of course, means, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles, they can be loaded with nuclear warheads. So that is a significant development indeed.
Sure. Okay, Pete, finally today, this is super interesting. The world's first wooden satellite, which was built by Japanese researchers, is set to launch tomorrow. What's going on here?
Yeah, it might just make space exploration a little more sustainable. And it's counterintuitive, isn't it? Wooden satellites.
Yeah.
You would think that, you know, something that has to get blasted up into space tens of thousands of miles, you know, would have to be made out of something a bit more robust than wood. But no, apparently satellites can be made out of wood. And scientists in Japan are set to test the theory this week. The Lignosat, ligno from the Latin for wood, which of course I'm sure you were aware of, Mark, that's been developed by a team from Kyoto University in Japan. And it's going to be launched later this week atop of a SpaceX rocket. And the rocket will be bound for the International Space Station. So it's said that it will be orbiting that for 6 months, and a number of other tests will be conducted just to test, well, how well the material will withstand the extreme environment of space. So one to look out for, launching this week, and a nice positive one to end on, I think, about with ideas of sustainability and perhaps it might help with the growing space junk problem of satellites and other defunct space equipment floating up in space that we're not sure what to do with.
Sure. All right. That is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
Like a lot of first-time voters, Sophie Stern couldn't wait to cast her vote for president. But identity politics are complicated for Sophie, who has Down syndrome. The show's Amy Silverman, Sophie's mom, explains.
Hey, Mom, what's an abortion? I choked on my cocktail. What? What's an abortion? I put down my glass, cleared my throat, and turned to my younger daughter. We were having family dinner on the patio of a favorite Phoenix restaurant, reveling in one of the first cool evenings after the hottest October any of us could remember. Talk had turned to the election. Of course it had. Typically, Sophie gets mad when anyone brings up politics. She'd rather discuss the winners of Dancing with the Stars or tell us about her latest musical theater role. But tonight, Sophie wasn't playing video games under the table or texting me that she was bored. She was listening. Maybe because there's just no escaping the election. Even her beloved Taylor Swift is in on it. Maybe because she's growing up. And because, for the first time, she's old enough to vote in a presidential election. I took a long sip of gin and leaned over, speaking softly into her ear. Okay. So an abortion is a medical procedure a woman gets if she is pregnant but does not want to have the baby. There can be a lot of reasons for this. Because some people believe that a baby is a baby before it's born, there are a lot of fights over whether it's okay for a woman to make this decision. I looked at Sophie. You know what I mean? Yeah, she nodded. She seemed satisfied with the answer, but I wasn't satisfied at all. What I wanted to tell her is that abortion is an impossibly complicated topic for anyone, but more so for her and for me. That if I'd known I was pregnant with a baby with Down syndrome, I almost certainly would have had an abortion. I didn't know anything about Down syndrome then. The doctors just made it clear that it was bad. I wanted to tell Sophie that I have thought about that every day since she was born. That Sophie and I and her whole world got really, really lucky when I didn't have an abortion. But I also wanted to tell Sophie that I worry every day that she will someday become pregnant with a child she doesn't want or never intended to have and won't have access to a legal abortion. That carrying a baby to term against her will could jeopardize both her physical and mental health. I worry about that for her older sister, too. But the truth is that for Sophie, it's different. It will always be different. Still, for better or worse, Sophie is now an adult. And while she may not understand all the nuances around the abortion debate, I didn't either at 21. This week, Sophie casts her ballot. We've been talking a lot about identity politics, about women and people of color serving in office. On a walk the other night, I asked her, what about a president with Down syndrome? Sophie didn't hesitate. She pumped her fist. I'll do it. You've got my vote, Soph.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now it's time for the next edition of our series, Chef Talk. Here we sit down with a chef each month, from fine dining rooms to nightclub kitchens, and find out what makes them tick. Today, let's head up Central Avenue into the heart of Sunny Slope and sit down at a table with Kevin Min, chef and owner of Sushi Friend. But Min says he's not a chef. Sushi is all he knows how to make, and he sort of fell into it by accident. It was 20 years ago, and he needed a job.
We went to a friend's gathering, and there was an executive chef there among mutual friends, and then he asked me what I was doing, and I was like, nothing. And he's like, okay, well, come do sushi tomorrow. So I started there.
Come do sushi tomorrow. So you show up in the kitchen knowing nothing about it?
Yeah, I didn't know how to do anything. Like, the first day I showed up, and he just took me to the back and took me to the prep guy, and he's like, well, here you go, I'll see you later.
Sushi Friend started with just Kevin in the place. He designed the entire menu around it, in fact. He didn't want to hire a cashier, so he put in ordering kiosks. He designed every item on the menu to only take a minute or two to assemble, so he could do it really quickly. Well, a few years in, he doesn't have that problem anymore. He's got a team in the kitchen, rave reviews are racking up, and he's considering expansion. It all changed for him when Instagram food influencer Diana Brandt, a.k.a. AZ Foodie, stopped by. Then Yelp put him at number 11 on its list of the top 100 sushi spots this year. All of the success comes after a long career in sushi kitchens across the valley, where we began our conversation.
I started with Raw, and then the chef from there went to open up Stingray, and then he brought me along back in 2004. And then I've been there my whole career until it was done. Yeah.
So it closes. You kind of do your own thing for a while. What did that look like for you? And then, of course, the pandemic was thrown in the middle of this.
Luckily, a chef from Roca gave me a call, and I was able to work there under them for a while, which was great. It was like a super cool learning experience. They were a super fancy restaurant, fine dining. And then after that, yeah, I floated around, tried to open up like a poke shop with someone, and it fell through. And I was like running around trying to do catering, and then COVID, and trying to sell sushi platters out of my house. And, you know, here I am at the store.
Right. So let's talk about Sushi Friend and where this place came from and kind of how you got it started. It was just you at the beginning, right?
Yes, it was just me, and it was pretty slow. I was watching like episodes of Netflix here for a while, and then AZ Foodie came, and she really picked us up, and I was able to get a friend in full time, and we were just chugging along, and then we got the Yelp award, and then that really set us off.
It's interesting how it's those moments or like those kind of random encounters that seem to either make a restaurant or break a restaurant, right?
It really is. I mean, like, everything came as a surprise. I never called AZ Foodie, and I never knew that Yelp even had those awards. So, and they all came at such a pivotal time when we needed, like, a boost. And then just right on time, just it comes and we're off.
Yeah. Okay, so talk a little bit about finding this space. We're in Sunny Slope and kind of a worn-down building that you've redone here. This must have been a project when you undertook it.
Yeah, there was like nothing here. New plumbing, new electrical, new roof, new anything and everything that we're surrounded by is had to be put in.
I mean, so that's a risk, right? Like a financial risk in a way to start a place like this and put a lot into it. Was it a little terrifying if it didn't take off?
Yeah, I mean, it was COVID. I had my second kid, there were babies, and we had whatever savings we had. And luckily, my lady kind of pushed me to throw it all in and to build the restaurant. And man, I don't know how we made it. We like barely made it to pay the rent and the mortgage by the time we opened. And then I was able to make mortgage and I was able to make rent like a week later. So it was good.
Tight though, man. So, I mean, let's talk about the concept here. Like this, you said you kind of designed a lot of this because it was literally just you, the only person in here when you started. How has that affected the concept to begin with?
I think initially it was all out of necessity, but after it was built, I noticed a lot of the industry, you know, friends coming in and just like really enjoying the concept and wanting it for themselves. So I knew I had something good then that might be able to expand eventually sometime in the future. And it's been going good so far.
Okay, I want to ask about how it is that you approach making sushi and how it is that you make sushi well. Sushi is really interesting because, well, it's not cooked, right, often. And then, like, you're going to have a big difference, it seems to me, between really bad sushi and really good sushi, even when it seems like it's the same thing on the menu.
I think, for me, it starts with the chef. And even I feel like even if you do have mediocre ingredients, if you have a chef, I don't want to say a chef that cares, but chef that kind of knows how to put it together, they'll make a good item. And for me, I had very limited amounts of ingredients that I could get in the beginning, so I developed my menu around that and also the time it would take to make each item. Because I had to make it alone, so I just made the menu according to, hey, this can't take more than a minute and this can't more than 3 minutes. Yeah.
Okay, so like literally down to the minute. Do you think that made it better in a way because you had to simplify and like often dishes get too fancy?
I think so because I usually don't call myself a chef. I just know how to put the ingredients that I have to the best of my abilities. And I know that a lot of chefs, they can come and it's like the menu's so simple and it's only the basic items of fish that we carry, but we just try to put it together as best as we can with what we have, and it's nothing too crazy.
Is it about the cut of fish or how you cut the fish? I'm always curious about this in sushi.
I think it's both. You got to cut it the right way, and you got to have good product, and then you got to put it together right, I'm going to say. I mean, you can get a nigiri that looks great, but anybody can make a nigiri look great by molding the rice forever, right? You want that nigiri very soft and the rice very soft and airy. And I think it takes a little bit more skill to do that. But anybody can make a nigiri look great once you touch it for like 10 minutes.
So it's about technique.
Yes, yes.
So it seems as if this restaurant has really kind of reached a tipping point for you and you may be at the precipice of expanding. Am I right?
I mean, wishfully thinking, I would love to because it's not just for me now. I have like 6-7 dudes here that's trying to progress and grow. So in order for all of us to do that, I feel like they would need something that they can grow with instead of just me here. Thinking about them, I think we just need to expand eventually.
Yeah. Why Sunny Slope? I wonder that, because it's such an interesting spot in Phoenix with such an interesting kind of vibe.
Well, I live here. I was like 30 seconds away from my store, and I knew how much Sunny Slope support their joints in their neighborhood, even if it's like a mile radius. So I told my lady, I was like, even if I could get a quarter mile radius of my shop, I feel like we can sustain. It ended up definitely being a little bit more, but that was the only reason. I knew that if I get this spot, I would be okay. But if it was a location anywhere else, I knew it wasn't something I wanted to take on. I would only take it on if it was this one.
All right. Kevin Min, thank you so much for having me out. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much, everybody.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.